Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butterfat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice for chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label, and for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
This concept of transportable food that was often refrigerated or room temperature could be a very delightful experience, and that even the unwrapping of it, the whole experience felt like a gift, you know?
This is Taste. I'm your host, Matt Rodbard. Today we have Susan Kim in the studio. Susan is a chef, food stylist, and the proud Korean-American business owner behind Doshi. Susan was born in Seoul and raised in California, and she cooked at Chez Panisse before moving to New York City in 2016. On this episode, we get into her take on the modern Korean food scene and her journey working both in restaurants and in food editorial. It's so great having Susan in the studio, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. Susan Kim, welcome. This is Taste. How are you? It's great to see you.
It's great to see you. Thank you for having me.
We have a lot to cover. I really appreciate, you know, shooting with you, with Alex, for Korea World. This is part of Korea World Week, and we're interviewing folks from the book. And really, you're somebody I've always wanted to have on the show, book or not, because you are in a lot of places at once. You have a really, like you're always innovating with your pop-ups, with Doshi. You're also food styling. You're in the mix. I just enjoy your work.
Oh, well, that's very nice. I mean, that also means a lot coming from you, I think. Game recognized game. Yeah, I mean, it. You kind of have to be all over the place, though, don't you think? Like, living in New York, like, it's the sum of all parts that kind of, every month you're just like, somehow we did it again.
Somehow we paid the rent. Somehow we got that pop-up done. Somehow, yeah. What's good in New York right now, restaurant-wise? I always want to tap in with somebody who knows what's going on.
I was actually kind of contemplating this question. I don't eat out that much anymore.
Yeah.
You know? Fair. But I will tell you what New York restaurants have, though. I think over, let's say, like, you know, L.A., where I kind of grew up, or the Bay Area, where I did spend a lot of time as well. I think, for me, New York restaurants have a thing, which is, the energy of the room is why you kind of want to be in that restaurant. Yeah. And for me, I like Servos is such a good example of that, because it's that like sardine can. And I don't know if I'm projecting, but it seems like everyone wants to be in that tiny room, including the cooks, the people that work there. It just feels really good in there. So, and the food's great, but it's really about the combination of all of it.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's a fun restaurant. This is in New York City, but I just visited Emil and Lauren Stonick upstate. I think Cafe Mutton.
Yeah, it's good.
They might compromise to a certain extent, but it seems like Shayna's cooking whatever they want to cook. You know, I respond to that a lot.
I mean, it's like British country food. I mean, it's really with like Francified elements too.
Totally.
It's really, really, it's sauce driven. It's like technique driven. It's got a great egg sandwich. It's got like really cool offal. I enjoy that restaurant.
Yeah. And I think that they're pulling from all sorts of inspiration too, like the bologna sandwich. I mean, I don't know them terribly well, but there's something poetic about it. You know, I remember a seared lamb heart with like salsa verde on a brunch menu.
I know. I had that.
Exactly.
It was cool.
It was me and you.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like the biggest crowd pleaser like for like some of the crew up there, but I just love, yeah, it's a good call.
Yeah.
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 But you're not eating out, is this you just cooking at home?
I mean, I guess. I had a great lunch at Aggie's the other day too.
Yeah.
I feel like these places are also places that I'm like, man, they care. Somebody really cares back there. And it might not necessarily be the chef owner. It most likely is not. But you can tell when someone cares.
Small things. Yeah, they add
up. Yes.
Good call. Well said, Susan. So you lived in Seoul until you were seven. And when we were talking about your cooking in America during our interview, you brought up this idea that Koreans growing up in Seoul and in Korea grow up instinctual cooks. I'd love you to unpack that a bit. I think it was such a great thought.
I mean, obviously, it's based on my own upbringing, because certainly there are a lot of Korean-Americans that don't grow up eating the way that I did. But the way that I grew up eating, whether it was inside my mom's own kitchen or, you know, going out to the local samgyeopsal place, like which is like pork belly, is that you got to get in there, man. Like the so like if we're talking about the instinctual thing, like goryeomtang or like those milky bone broth,
types sulmantang,
sulmantang, that'll arrive completely unseasoned. That's how it was in my house, right? But there is a shitload of sliced scallions and some coarse salt, oftentimes gakdugi, the radish kimchi, or some, you know, Napa cabbage kimchi also. And you are doctoring and seasoning as you go. You are seeing that the kimchi is adding salinity and seasoning, but also adding these like acid bites, these crunchy textural bites to richness. From a very young age, I was always like a scallion. I wanted it like covered with scallions.
Yeah, you knew your sulmantang had to be well seasoned. You're not more of that muted side,
right? Yep. And then the usage of just the salt, as well, right? Oh, yeah. And then obviously that differentiates between every, you know, my brother or my dad, but like everyone's kind of, it's like a shared experience, but then they're on their own adventure as well.
And
I think the whole instinctual cook thing for me is that it's imbued on you how to taste and what you like to taste. And I think that's such a fundamental thing about being a cook.
Yeah.
And then if you go out and you're at a Korean barbecue place, I mean, granted, there are so many places that are like cutting the meat and flipping it for you, but a lot of times you're going in there, you're seeing
don't
where the hot spots.
Don't be afraid to touch the tongs.
Exactly. You're
don't
seeing where the hot spots are. You're seeing like if you want a little more color on that. You're engaged. You're there. And I think those are the things to me that was like very like instinctual and second nature that not everyone kind of grows up with.
That's amazing. And did you make the rice at home too when you were young?
Oh, that was one of the definitely the first things I learned. Absolutely.
My friend raises, he's Korean American family, raises his daughter to make the rice. And it's just like a great, you know, there's a lot of cooking in Korean household, a lot of shared food experiences.
Oh, yeah. And all those lessons. And I don't know how your friend taught his kid, but there was no measuring.
Yeah, you do the knuckle thing with the water level. I think his is like push the button on the cuckoo. Yeah. The cuckoos are dope. I mean, that's, the kids are quite young, so
yeah,
it's a modern story. But
also think about that in terms of how like the meal really begins or centers around rice too.
I know.
Which I think is also powerful.
We have a whole section of modern rice, we call it, and it's kind of modern takes on rice dishes and with Korean lens. I want to get into your career a bit. I think it's a really cool career.
I'm glad you think so.
Well, no, I mean it, because I think when you teeter between professional kitchens and food styling, and you do both, because I consider pop-ups highly professional, and I've been to a couple of them. They're great. But you worked at Chez Panisse for a while.
I did. I mean, I guess it's a while considering what, like, sort of the times that people are putting in kitchens now. I worked close to 4 years there.
Yeah.
And it was informative and integral, and it sort of extends what we're already talking about, which I think there's so many takeaways and lessons from my time there. But one of the key things is it really teaches you how to taste. And so I think that's such an important thing.
Yeah.
You know, and because there were some cooks that I worked with that had like bounced and then came back. One of them had gone and worked at a TK kitchen, Thomas Keller kitchen. And he was like, there's kits for everything in that kitchen, including beans. And, and we were like, wait, what? But I also understood that point of view, because to ensure consistency on that level, every single thing is going to be weighed, including salt. But there's a lot of factors on why that also is not going to ensure consistency. It's like, how long have those beans been sitting around, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's just so many factors.
And if there is less feel and taste in the actual day-to-day cooking, it might be a little bit less, you know, lower quality.
Right. And so, but I think given that, there were really no recipes there, with the exception of certain things like soufflés, I remember. I remember very few recipes that we looked at. You learn to cook by looking at what you're handling, the source of heat, if applicable, and to taste and continue to taste.
That's amazing. You work under Cal Peter now?
I worked under Cal for a little bit. He went as one of the downstairs chefs quickly after I left. And I worked under Beth Wells and Nathan. Mm-hmm. And those are the two cafe chefs. But it's interesting because Shay has such a long storied history, but there were cooks there from the 80s still. But then there were
such a vibe, such a hang, I'm sure, with the with the crew, right?
Right. But wow. then there were these new generation or new like crew of cooks that were coming that were like, they're gonna get their year and bounce. You know, if you make it a year, that's still something. You know, I just thought it now there's just so many different ways to.
Yeah. Well, Susan, what kept you there? Because four is a commitment. Did you live in Berkeley? Did you like
I didn't. I was one of these rare people that actually, or maybe nobody. I lived in San Francisco and I commuted into Berkeley. I was in a rent controlled apartment in San Francisco and I was just. Yeah, it was one of those things that made sense in that way.
Yeah, right. But let me ask you, what kept you there?
I mean, here's the thing. I don't want to go too deep into this because, you know, TLDR, but I lost a partner to cancer during that time. And cooking is something that it could be whatever you want it to be, meaning it was the only thing that could get me out of the multiple tabs that were open on my computer about cancer research, anecdotal stuff that I was reading about, you know, what my partner was going through, all of this stuff. If you are cooking something under an 800 wood oven, you have to be there because your eyelashes are burning. It takes you out of it. And then when there were like things that were more like prep oriented tasks, like say like just taking the meat off of a lamb shoulder and it's taking hours, you kind of go into a meditative state too. Like, cooking for me really saved me during that time. And in terms of just processing what was going on with a partner that was ill.
Yeah.
And then it was in about a span of 2 years that he ultimately died. But it was it really, timing wise, I was like, oh, like this is the only thing that could get me out of that. That headspace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Working these pretty long hours.
And just, and what cooking was in terms, it could be whatever you want it to be, you know? So, I mean, that's why it was like, in timing wise, it was extremely, I give everything to cooking. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. That's a great personal story that you shared, and that's a lot to go through. And then it's really powerful.
There's nothing. And you also, you cook so much too. It's incredible just to be there with something, right? You're like, I don't want this to burn, or where is it? Like, there's no choice but to be present. And I think that's one of the many, many gifts of cooking.
Really, really well said. Let's talk about moving on to food styling, because that's kind of like your pivot away from restaurant cooking. You started working as a food stylist and you started working in food editorial, commercial. I'd love to get a sense of making that transition and your decision to do that. It's cool that you made that move.
I mean, to tell you the truth, I don't do that much of it now.
Yeah.
And I think I'm still interested in it if the person or the group or the project in itself is like interesting. So I came to New York City to help open a now defunct restaurant called Agern.
I know. I saw that. Grand Central Station.
Literally from like Berkeley, where it's almost like in a kitchen that's like kind of like in a Luddite space, like it's like all open fire, to a kitchen that had no windows, underground, Grand Central, all induction, not a lot of active smells.
Klaus Meyers, the chef,
yes,
from famously co-founder of Noma,
one of the
big
exactly.
opening. I mean, listen, hell of an opening party for Agard. That party was, I just like still remember
and,
that party.
And like we got the 3 stars from Time.
Yeah,
and
you did.
All of that, but it was such an antithesis and a departure from where I was coming from. And actually, Klaus is the one, if you want to say, like, who recruited me, because he came into Shea when I was on the line one night and it kind of, we struck up this conversation. All to say, it got me to New York, but after that opening period happened, and I think I stayed on 6 months after, what I noticed in the New York scene in terms of like people working were that a lot of my acquaintances, coworkers that had traditionally worked in restaurants were now doing various different jobs, including styling and food media. So that's sort of how I fell into it. I started assisting.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I met so many friends that are so important to me to this day. I feel like what's keeping me in New York are these friendships. And, you know, it's, you meet the most incredible people through work.
I love it. Yeah. And in this world, the food media, restaurant world, it's characters, it's passion, it's a lot of dedication. And I love that you articulate this so well about how the people is why you stuck around.
I mean, you know, I think food styling, I think there are people that are so good at it. I think, you know, it's something that exercise is a different part of the brain, obviously. I think I sort of phased out of it in a way that, like, maybe I, you know, the things that people do on such a huge, like, advertorial level, you know, that's a different thing. But it, for me, it was sort of exemplifying the density of New York and the types of work that are available. Cause, you know, someone's writing a book, someone's on this shoot, someone's throwing this event. There's so much going on at all times.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the way you run your pop-up.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, not New York-based. It's, like, sometimes in Paris, you do a lot there. It'll be on the West Coast sometimes. It'll be in New York sometimes.
Yeah.
And really, it's based around Doshi Rock, which is like the lunch boxes that young Korean school children take to school. And you've kind of made that a bit of, you know, it's your brand, but you also, mm-hmm. it's a spiritual North Star of sorts. This is my read of it, because you're not necessarily doing only boxes, but you have like a real, I'd love to hear, Susan, your kind of what Eat Doshi is all about.
You know, it's ever evolving.
Sure.
As we are as human beings, I think. You know, it's so funny because I'm always like, it's interesting, like, because we were talking about the tote bag that I have, which is, like, the one merch item I have.
Like the size,
but I'm like, is this going to be, like, you know, a Tony Shea Zappos moment, which I don't even know if I should even mention him because whatever. But, like,
yeah, R.I.P., like, I guess. Like,
R.I.P., but
that guy kind of crashed and burned.
But, like, meaning, like, his whole thing was that, like, he was never passionate about shoes. It just is a company that launched on, like, a philosophy and a mantra and, like, a business that evolved. I'm just wondering at one point, like, am I going to be able to connect the dots and look back and be like, remember when you cooked food, you know? But all to say, like, the concept was Toshirox, like you mentioned. And it was timely in the sense that it was peak pandemic. Things really quieted down. It was, the hustle culture was non-existing. But what was happening in terms of the community of food and those around food and selling food was that there was an openness and a reception and a receptiveness to sharing kitchens. And I think people were open to even different concepts, not just their like regular go-to restaurants. And then the model of takeout, right? People were like just picking up stuff. And I had already and always envisioned Toshirox or Doshi boxes because of how amazing they were in Korea and also bentos in Japan. This concept of transportable food that was often refrigerated or room temperature could be a very delightful experience. And that even the unwrapping of it, the whole experience felt like a gift, you know? And then Toshi means city in Korean. And I was like, New York City is the city for me.
Yeah, it has a lot of meaning there. Yeah,
yeah, and it's given me so much. And so, you know, launching it here totally made sense. But to your point, it has gone in different places and evolved geographically, gone to different areas. And the box concept is definitely one branch that I do, but it's now, you know, like the next few pop-ups, one is going to be at a hotel kind of, you know, bringing on this concept of cave, like wine cave, and then the next one will be like a full-on dinner. It's sort of whatever the space dictates and whatever feels like that's what.
Yeah, you're not putting yourself, like, it doesn't have to be literally in a box.
I do like what a Toshiba can be.
I mean, in the book, in Korea World, we have a fun profile with the Soul Sausage guys, Young and Ted from LA, and they do Doshi Rock themselves.
Oh, nice.
And their business is a little different. They do catering. It's mostly for like studios, it's all Doshi Rock, and it's
wait,
dope.
That's brilliant, because in terms of that business model, I would love to talk to them.
Yo, you should. They link with them. They're cool.
I mean,
people.
That game is about scaling.
Yeah, and they have a great commissary, and those guys used to run Soul Sausage as a brick and mortar downtown in the Arts District, and now they're just doing a lot more. But it's taking this idea of Doshi Rock, but kind of making it larger than literally just the lunchbox.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about Panchan, because I love when we chatted about it for the book and the piece I wrote about you in Korea World, you came up with this idea, and I really buy it, is like anything can be Panchan. Mm-hmm. And like when you were growing up, on the West Coast, after you moved here when you were 7, it seemed like the way Panchan was served in your family home was minimal at times, also extravagant at times too. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to get a sense of how anything can be Panchan.
Anything could be Panchan, because my mom really showed that, exemplify that. And a couple of key examples, and I feel like we've talked about this, are Kraft American singles that she would cut into pieces that we could pick up with our chopsticks. That was a Panchan.
Absolutely. Totally.
A pimenton stuffed olive was a Panchan. Yeah. And it's not just those are all existing on its own, but it could be with like kakdugi and a muchim. It's assemblage of all kinds of things. And now, also in hindsight, I haven't really actually asked my parents this, but I think they were pulling some miracles, meaning like, you know, I never ever felt like we lack for things, but I know that, like, of course, there were, you know, situations where they had to stretch a paycheck or so forth. And so they were just like these things that they were pulling out, or my mom specifically. The thing about anything can be Panchan is, yeah, absolutely anything could be Panchan. There has to be papdo, you know, like meaning like the rice.
Yep.
And if you have like rice, then anything could be.
You can put a little Kraft single on rice, or you can put a muchim. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And now I feel like also I love like having like, I don't know how you feel about like day old rice. I mean, of course I fuck with it, but like I love fresh rice. You know that when like, the moment you open it, you let steam. That final residual steam go, and then you're fluffing it.
You fluff it, and you serve it, and you spoon it, and then you've got about 2 minutes before it starts to die.
Yeah, and that rice, to me, is the best thing in the world.
Yeah. And Dayo I will fuck with, but for bokkeumbap.
Sure.
You know, and I think fried rice, to me, and someone who didn't grow up eating a lot of rice, so I have a different relationship, but for me, and I love the way we do a roasted gochujang sauce for our bibimbap that we do is like a Korean air homage. I feel like that sauce and rice is like the greatest thing.
Oh, yeah. And that also, like, if you're talking about bokkeumbap or fried rice or even chuk or anything like that, like, sometimes you will even intentionally, like, dry out certain things.
Definitely.
I'm really into making pugak right now.
Yeah.
So that is essentially, like, chuk or congee that you are using as a paste for kim, these seaweed sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, there's... You know, there's nothing wasted, but nothing like that moment when you're like, I'm fluffing the rice.
I'd love to read a longer work of your panchans. I feel like you could do 100 panchan.
I mean, panchans?
You're very smart creatively.
I mean, I think it's like, you know, the concept of things that you learn in like quote-unquote professional kitchens, like family meal, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's literally like what panchan, it's like, let's make something out of this.
I know, it is.
Which is amazing.
It's the Yangban Panchan right now, they're doing like Asian pear and avocado and things like that. They're doing a cool thing where they're doing, they're taking like beshu kimchi that's like old makgeolji, like old school, old stuff, and like they're doctoring it.
Yeah.
Like they're bringing in it from an old, like a market, but like adding sesame oil and doctoring it. I think it's really cool.
Totally. And then to cook with it, right?
Then you cook with it.
Yeah.
Right. Like panchan can be like, you can take it and then cook with it. It can like go from the kitchen table to the kitchen.
I mean, kimchi in itself, if you're talking about the ultimate banchan, is kimchi. And man, the different stages of kimchi, if you think about it, it's pretty amazing.
Oh, right? I mean, like, especially just the best shoot, just like right out of the bowl after you've made it, the fresh kimchi.
Oh, that's like my favorite, when you're actually just like putting the paste on. That's yeah.
Yeah, it's like a salad. I mean, it's like the same as a
salad.
Oh,
it's great. And then cooking with it too. It's like, I made kimchi jjigae the other day and I was just like, you really only need to add water because everything in here is in here.
Just like kimchi, just best shoot kimchi and water.
Because the kimchi was ginger and garlic and fish sauce and shrimp and oysters. I mean, of course we could make some sort of a stock. And honestly, you know, those nuanced things will add to it.
Yeah,
but I was like,
bake into it if you want.
But
you know.
Yeah, exactly. This was a macro one, but like, it's all in there.
Yeah, word. I'm into that. And man, green home cooking is just, I love it so much. It's so interesting to talk through each house to house how kimchi jjigae is made, right?
Yeah.
So fun.
And then how people are particular about their kimchi too. And it usually stems from the mom stuff. It all does.
Yeah,
it
your
always
mom's
goes
style.
Back to mom. Yeah.
I got to ask you about the modern Korean restaurant scene in New York. And we've talked about it this week a lot. Yeah. And it's a big, big topic. I've been really like fortunate to be able to write about Odukki in Korea World, about this modern scene on each coast and also happening in Seoul. But from you, from a professional point of view, it must have been really interesting to you in the past 5 years to live in New York and see so many restaurants open, framed as Korean restaurants from people of many different backgrounds, but mostly Korean Americans or Korean chefs. Susan, what have you thought about this movement? And I'd love to get a few of your favorite places, past and present.
I'm so excited about it, just like I think any sort of consumer or a restaurant patron that is excited about eating out, right? I mean, you know, when you live in a city like New York, or I think a common conversation is like, have you been there? It's like this topic, right? Or when are you going to go there? Or, you know, that whole thing. Like, and absolutely, it's super exciting. I feel like I haven't gone to too many places. I really want to go to Ari Ari.
I mean, Clayton's here. He's edited all the episodes. I've mentioned that restaurant, I would say 20 times.
I don't literally. I feel like the homies that I've gone through, only positive words.
It's the albop alone. The albop with uni cream.
Oh, I mean, say no more.
It's a fire dish. It's really perfectly thought through. They have an amazing salad. I'm sorry, listener, you've heard me say this three times, but if you haven't, here it is. They have this amazing ganjang salad. So it's a ganjang dressing with a little bit of anchovy, I think, flake. It's got it's umami rich.
Yeah.
But it has a sweetness with maishal, I think. There's some maishal in there.
Yeah.
It's really, really cool, the balance there. And then I think what they're known for is like some of their bone broth soups.
I mean, I definitely, yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if this is part of that move, but I had a really good meal at Ole, which is next to, I think, Oksangdaek or something like that. I just thought they were like, it was just solid. I mean, it was just good food.
I agree. And the naengmyeon's really good there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had naengmyeon and galbi.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff.
I feel like that the fact that there is such a hunger for it and that people are so receptive to it, it's an exciting time to be like, what is it that we want to eat? What is it that we want to make? What is Korean food? What is Korean American? We don't have to have a singular definitive thing about it all. And I think that conversation, as it continues to broaden, is what's exciting about it.
I love that sentiment. Totally agree. And we don't have to define it. We don't have to put it in any kind of boxes. But just the volume of it, like Day back in Brooklyn, that's a cool place too. Day.
And, yeah. I mean, they're going through some stuff.
Yeah. I know. I'm not caught up. Not caught up.
No, but what's dope was like, I was in there. I was like, this is a $300 food. I think Korean folks, and maybe I'm just projecting my own shit, but the fact that like we have the gall to like be like, yes, our stuff is worth this much, I'm like, go ahead.
Yeah, right. Whatever.
You know what I mean?
I gotta look into this Day. They have a tasting menu now?
Oh no! It was just because they have a little bit of a retail experience.
Oh, I see.
And so they were just selling these like beautiful spoons and plates from Korea.
That's good. Yeah, right on. Beautiful work. Yeah, I like that. It's a shared space, so it's exciting to see Korean American restaurants flourish.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these are straight from the motherland.
Yeah, true.
You know, and so, but that there's an absolute hunger for it.
Yeah, yep, yep. Oakland yeah. Chick was a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
Cookbook in your future? What do you think?
I think it would be really fun.
Yeah.
I think I have experience working on them with friends. I have experienced it with certain friends that are going through it now. Yeah, I'm interested. And I'm just wondering also how much of this stuff is about ego, though. Meaning, like, cookbooks are projects that, for me, what's exciting about it is because I think there's that sort of old school person in me that loves to handle something tactile. It's a book.
Yeah, right.
But unless you're Ina Garten, like, is anybody making money off of these books? I don't know. But cookbooks, there's still such a hunger for it. I mean, you tell me. You kind of know.
I'd answer, yes, people are making money because, yes, they're selling. And I think there's a real appetite for cookbooks. And I really think, talk about an affordable luxury. I mean, for $24 to $35, you're getting 100 to 150 recipes that are tested. You're getting beautiful stories.
And years of work.
And years of work. Yeah. And, like, you know, the fact of the matter is, and seriously, this is not a shot, but, like, BA cost $11 on the new stand, and you know, Cherry Bomb and the new Savour cost $25 each. That's the price. Like, that's
yeah.
And, like, I'm glad they're charging that. They should, because it takes that much money to make a magazine. But we're making books here, and we're selling them for around the same price. And these are books. So I think there's, like, a ton of value in books.
I still do buy books.
Thank you. We're recording this at Penguin Random House. I appreciate you buying books.
On 57th Street, which now I know. I also love, I think that you and I are the types of people that are also reading cookbooks, not for just recipes, but we're actually, I read them almost like a chronological sort of.
Me too.
And just the way that people have really been so vulnerable in these cookbooks too, and the way that you really understand how certain people are thinking about dishes.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing.
I love it.
And also, you know, I was like thinking about like a French onion soup the other day, and I was like, instead of just like looking online, why don't you see if any of your books have it? And the thing is, of course there's a book in our shelf that's going to reference it or have it, right? But like just going to cookbooks more. I mean, I guess I was being a little bit of, like, not facetious, but yes, I'm definitely interested in the cookbook.
I hope you do. Yeah. I hope you do. On This Is Taste, we ask guests about their discerning taste. So to close this interview, here's a little rapid fire, fast and furious taste check. Susan, are you ready?
Sure, sure.
The best fruit.
Best fruit? I mean, strawberry, peak.
Peak. The worst vegetable.
I guess just like a flimsy green raw bell pepper that's like in like a plastic wrap situation.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
You don't
about.
Want that. Only maybe on pizza.
Yeah.
The best dessert.
Ice cream.
What kind?
Chocolate.
Yeah, word.
Basic.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's good. Favorite American fast food chain?
In-N-Out or Popeyes.
Oh, yeah. Both are very, very good answers.
Popeyes is the only place where the food that you get is the same. It looks the same as the ad.
Yeah, yeah, right on. They have the Craig. You're right. I mean, Steak Shake,
so
I would say the other one, but yeah.
Yeah.
Favorite new cookbook discovery?
You know the comprehensive Korean cookbook from Faidon?
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful.
JP, yeah, did a good job with
that. I think it's the homage to quote unquote the masters too at the end, and it's been so informative for me. And then a recent one that has become, it's an oldie but a muse of mine, is a Two Fat Ladies cookbook that was published in 2000.
I love that reference. Such a good...
Called Obsessions. And it's become a muse for me for my own book, I think.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah,
I love that reference.
Yeah.
Favorite city outside America to visit for food?
I mean, it's easy, but Seoul.
Duh. Yeah. I mean, the end.
You can go back, you can go back three times a year and you'll be like, when
it would
this
be ill
up?
To do that. I've been recently and it's such a fun city to hang.
Yeah.
Last one, your favorite sandwich?
It's either an Italian sandwich or a jambon beurre, right?
That is a great answer. I mean, both of those are like two different polars.
Yeah.
Poles.
Yeah.
I'm a big jambon beurre fan, so.
Yeah.
Susan Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So good. This Is Taste is hosted by Eliza Abarbanel and me, Matt Rodbard. The show is produced by Shalia Harris and Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Theme music by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter for updates on all cool things that are happening.